KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You've heard the arguments about whether we're too politically correct as a society. Seems like we go through cycles in the debate of what we can or should say in public. It was big in the 80s and 90s. Seems to be back again. Greg Lukianoff has been observing this new PC movement, and he says it's driven mostly by students on college campuses around the country to clean up words and ideas and subjects that cause discomfort or give offense. He says there's a big difference between this new movement and the others. This one, he says, is mostly about emotional well-being. So he believes a campus is not being seen as a place where you're confronted and challenged by difficult ideas, but where you're being shielded and protected from them. Today in the program, we're talking with Lukianoff about what this means for education and for young people's mental health after the news.
Friend, follow, and join us on social media to stay connected with the latest goings-on. Find out who's on Radio West tomorrow, what's happening on Capitol Hill, and get a glimpse behind the microphones with pictures and videos of station staff and special events. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Twitter. Search for KUER 90.1.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you're a parent, you have a unique insight into the debate over whether you're too politically correct. We are, anyway, on college campuses and other places in the country, because a lot of this is based on the question of how much do you expose students to? How far do you go to challenge them or confront their point of view? And when do you protect their sensibilities? Some comedians like Jerry Seinfeld and Bill Maher don't do college gigs anymore. They've said this new generation of young people are way too easily offended. Basically, they can't take a joke. And every now and again, you have students who protest the speakers at commencement. The IMF's Christine Lagarde was disinvited to speak. So was former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Greg Lukianoff has been exploring this latest movement of political correctness, which he believes has created a culture in which people are thinking twice before speaking up for fear of being called insensitive or a bigot. He's co-written an article for The Atlantic with the social psychologist Jonathan Haidt that looks at the effects of this culture on education and, this seems to be the interesting twist, and on mental health. Greg Lukianoff is president and CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. It's a nonprofit organization focused on civil liberties on America's college campuses. I mentioned the article he wrote, co-wrote with Jonathan Haidt. It's called The Coddling of the American Mind. It's the cover story for the Atlantic Magazine's September issue. We have a link to it on our website. Greg Lukianoff is joining us from a studio in the Atlantic's offices in New York City. And Greg Lukianoff, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
I wanted to begin, I guess, by getting a definition of what we mean by being politically correct. There's an article a lot of people know about. Jonathan Chait wrote this article, and I think it was in January, that kind of got the ball rolling. You've been thinking about this and writing about this for a long time, but he wrote this article that a lot of people were discussing where he said that this culture of political correctness wasn't about he called it a system of left-wing ideological repression. Mm-hmm. Your focus is more on kind of the mental health aspects of all of this, but how do you describe political correctness right now? We'll get into the particulars as we go.
I'm going to make a confession that might surprise some people. I actually really – and I really don't like the term political correctness, partially because it's unfortunately the most useful shorthand we have for sort of an establishment of an orthodoxy about the way we talk to each other. And it's usually refers to people coming from the left. But, you know, for example, Juan Williams talked about political correctness on the right. And I think that because it means such different things depending on where you're coming from, because if you talk to conservatives, they tend to think it's like ideological thought control, or which it actually sounds very much like Jonathan Chait, a perspective on it, who isn't a conservative. Right. Meanwhile, when you talk to people on the left, there's a lot of talk about political correctness as just politeness. And I still use it as a term. That's partially because it is good shorthand for the phenomena of people overreacting, of essentially saying, You're now going to be punished for running that racy article in class because it made students uncomfortable, for example.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of an unfortunate term, but we don't seem to have a good replacement for it.
It's so fraught. Come on, surely you can come up with a better one. Yeah. I'll leave that to you to figure out.
Well, that's why we talk more about vindictive protectiveness in the article than we do about political correctness.
Right. One of the big questions, too, is who's really driving this? Our guest later on the program is Angus Johnston. You've debated him before. What he says is a lot of this is being driven by college bureaucrats who are trying not to upset the alumni or the donors, the lawmakers. It seems like your focus is more on the students, that a lot of this is actually being driven by students.
You know, Angus and I actually agree more than you'd think. We actually agree quite a bit. And I've been doing this for 15 years. I'm a First Amendment lawyer. I worked for the ACLU of Northern California. You know, like I thought I'd seen it all. I used to study the history of censorship. And when I got onto campuses doing First Amendment work and free speech work on campuses, in 2001, for almost all of my career, it was overwhelmingly mid-level and in some cases upper-level administrators overreacting. Right. And I talk about that in the article as engaged in the cognitive distortion of catastrophizing, that essentially any small thing, they felt like they had to police it, they had to clamp down on students, they had to go after professors who were offending people. So for most of my career, I completely agree with Angus. And it's still a major problem that some of the worst cases you see are administrators overreacting. But I do where we probably differ is the fact in the past 2 years, and I've devoted my career to defending the free speech rights of students and due process rights for that matter as well. But it's been disappointing to me in the past couple of years that some of the desire for example, policing microaggressions or for getting people they don't like disinvited or for making mandatory trigger warning policies are coming from students, and that saddens me to a degree.
One of the things that you refer to in the article is sort of how we got here. Mm-hmm. Because there was this – and these sort of – I'll use the term political correctness. It's not the best one, but I'll mention throughout the hour.
So it's useful, unfortunately.
It is. And it raged for a time in the 80s and the 90s.
Sure.
But then it kind of – Chait mentions it goes into remission. You know, now it seems to be back. But you say there's a difference between the politically correct movement then and now. The earlier movement was trying to restrict mostly hate speech, you say, that called mm-hmm. for – but it also called for more diverse perspectives. But the version that you write about and seem to be worried about, obviously, is mostly about emotional well-being, that's a big part of the difference. Would you talk about that?
Definitely, from the two big political political correctness sort of movements, I'd say that a major theme in the first sort of movement when it was more student and professor driven in the late 80s and early 90s during the first great age of speech codes, as you might want to call it that, was that it was premised on an idea of empowerment, but it was also premised on an idea of going after racism, going after sexism, and it had it had an edge to it, but it was always predicated on an idea of empowerment. And what makes this version different to a degree is that it seems to be based on a premise of everybody's really fragile and students are really fragile, and therefore in the name of these people that I think are very very fragile, frankly, I think we should be providing trigger warnings, we should be passing speech codes, we should be firing professors, we should be punishing students who step out of line. And I think that that's the more sort of dangerous turn, because I think that if you start telling – Lenore Skenazy, who's sort of the creator of the free range kids movement, talks about this, that if you tell students all the time, if you tell them since they're little tiny kids to college age, you're very fragile and you're very easily wounded, that can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Meanwhile, if you tell them that they're resilient and debate can actually be fun and good for you, that can also be a more positive self-fulfilling prophecy.
You write about how today's young people kind of grew up in this stew where you have the media doing a lot of fear-mongering about the dangers everywhere. But you also then throw in something else into the mix, which is a political culture that's really polarized.
Oh, yeah. One thing I want to emphasize, I actually think that a lot of the problems that I end up dealing with culturally are ultimately the products – are basically the dark side of very good development. So political correctness comes from a great place of trying to be inclusive. It just ends up going, you know, a little bit overboard in some cases, or very overboard in some cases. I think it's a great thing when it comes to political polarization. I think it's incredible that we're able to move to communities increasingly that reflect our values, which a book called The Big Short shows that we have. Right. I think it's incredible that we have so many media options that we can listen to media all day that totally tells us exactly what we already think and completely mimics what we already believe. But of course, there's serious problems to that, because the more that you're told you're right, you're right, you're right, you're right, you're right, the more polarized. These polarization effects are incredibly easy to replicate in the lab, by the way. You can just put someone in a blue shirt and someone in a red shirt, leave them in different groups for a couple of hours, and they come back with negative opinions of the people in the blue shirts and vice versa. So I do think that political polarization does actually give this thing an additional edge.
In the article, you write about that crucial element to the Socratic method of teaching, which is critical thinking.
Yep.
And critical to that is this idea of putting a student in a place where they can be uncomfortable. They can even be angry.
Yep.
But here's where we get to that idea of vindictive protectiveness, because that's the impulse to protect students. And you say that when you do that, when you try to protect them from discomfort, that it teaches, and here's how you put it in the article, it teaches students to think in a different way. That's a really important point. Would you break that down for us?
Which part of it?
Well, this is what you say. You say this new protectiveness may be teaching students to think pathologically.
Right. Okay. And that's one of the reasons why we got really passionate about writing this article. And I think this is the interesting part of it, that the thing that we got the most excited about was taking the theory of cognitive behavioral therapy. And cognitive behavioral therapy is one of the most successful interventions for anxiety and depression of the last 50 years.
Right.
But what people who aren't familiar with cognitive behavioral therapy, they don't understand that what it is pretty much a daily practice of looking at your own thoughts, asking yourself, are they exaggerated? And comparing them to what are called cognitive distortions. So a classic cognitive distortion that we all – and by the way, we all do cognitive distortions. But a classic cognitive distortion is what's called dichotomous thinking. Either I'm going to be a huge success or my life is going to fall apart. If this person breaks up with me, it's all done for. If I blow this interview, that's it for me. You know, we all think like this to a degree. That's also catastrophizing, by the way.
Right.
And what's amazing about cognitive behavioral therapy is it turns out that if you get good at talking back to your own mind and saying, listen, is that really rational or fair to say that my life is over if this date goes poorly? And you learn the habits of not doing that. And it's incredibly effective for decreasing anxiety and depression. The thing that was fun about the article was to actually look at the way we're teaching people, the behavior we're modeling on campus, to make the point, wow, this is actually – I think we're actually modeling cognitive distortions. We're actually saying, wow, you should magnify. You should engage in personalization. You should engage in dichotomous thinking, which is not what universities should be doing for students.
Hmm. It's interesting that another thing you write about is that you're wondering if this new PC culture is coaxing students to think in more distorted ways.
Yep.
Which is to say, from you and Jonathan Haidt's perspective, higher education is focusing too much attention, and this is a big part of the article, mm-hmm. on emotion as a means of learning.
Right.
This idea of thinking emotionally rather than thinking, I don't know what the counter to that is, thinking rationally, thinking – I mean, talk a little bit about that part, this idea of thinking emotionally, because this is a big
Absolutely.
Part of the argument.
Absolutely. And don't misunderstand. You know, I think that thinking emotionally and being honest about your emotions are all wonderful, wonderful things. But here's the secret about rationality, and here's the secret about the way our brains work. We're not very good at rationality. We're not very good at rational argument. We're not very good at evaluating evidence. And we have to – it's really difficult, but we have to be trained to do that. And I think we're not doing a very good job of that on college campuses these days. And I think that if we want to have more productive arguments, we do have to do a better job of training people to argue rationally, argue fairly, ask them. Because one of the things that makes cognitive behavioral therapy so interesting and the theory of cognitive distortions is that – and one of the reasons why we think this has a much broader application than simply for helping people deal with – well, you know, incredibly helping people deal with anxiety and depression is that they're also just good rules for how we argue with each other. Hmm. And I think right now as a society, and you can particularly see this on social media, we're wasting an awful lot of brain power on outrage and why I'm your enemy and why we should disagree and why your point of view is evil. And I think that we could all learn a little from asking ourselves, am I magnifying? Am I engaged in personalization? Am I exaggerating this in my head? To have more productive discussions. And I think campuses could be so much more helpful to solve society's problems if we did focus a little bit more on are we arguing fairly with each other?
Well, one of the things you write about it, about all of this is kind of what it means to be wrong, how we perceive someone who doesn't agree with us. Here's what you write. You say, a claim that someone's words are offensive is not just an expression anymore of one's own subjective feeling of being offended, offendedness, as you put it, but it's become a charge that the speaker has done something objectively wrong.
Right. And that's the cognitive distortion of emotional reason,
yeah.
Where essentially if you feel something – it has to be there. Something has to be done about it, particularly if you feel something negative. And part of the point of the article was we're teaching students to a degree habits that will actually make them miserable. And if there's one peculiar thing, and we came to this article in part because for my own depression and anxiety, I started studying CBT very intensely, and it's been incredibly helpful to me. But it is hard to get used to saying to yourself sometimes. You are upset. Sometimes you are offended, but that's an emotion you should note, and then try to get back to: am I still listening to what this person is saying?
Greg Lukianoff is with us. He is president and CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. He co-wrote the cover story for the September issue of The Atlantic magazine. It's called The Coddling of the American Mind. He co-wrote it with Jonathan Haidt. We have a link to it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about political correctness. Our guest today, Greg Lukianoff, says this new generation of students is demanding to be shielded from words and subjects that may be upsetting. And it's not only messing up them emotionally, but also intellectually. He, Greg Lukianoff, and Jonathan Haidt co-wrote the cover story for the September issue of The Atlantic magazine. It's called The Coddling of the American Mind. We have a link to it on our website. Greg Lukianoff is with us to talk about it. So you don't make this direct causal connection, but you do note mental illness rates among young adults are rising, and you suspect there is a connection here, do you?
I do, and definitely I don't think higher education or K-12, you know, is the main culprit, but I do think that we're teaching students to be more fearful and children to be more fearful than they need to be. And also telling them they're less empowered and less competent to be able to handle the world as it is. And there's an irony in this, of course, in that we live in and it's funny because the one criticism that we got on The Atlantic was, oh, men saying it was harder in my day lecturing the younger generation. And of course, you know, I'm 40, so I guess I didn't think of myself as that old. But beyond that, you know, the thing that I wanted to challenge that a little bit. I'm like, my father grew up in 1926 in Yugoslavia. His father grew up in 1888 in the Russian Empire. His grandfather was a serf. It is absolutely true that you know, if you look backwards in time, people had – you know, bigger issues and much more precarious lives. So in a sense, you know, we're certainly doing a lot better than, you know, my father or my great-grandfather for that matter. But we're more anxious about it than possibly ever before. I think that's at least in part that people see, Dershowitz wrote a book about higher education that talks about how life or death, particularly sort of like what I would actually call upper class, you keep on calling middle upper class, but like no, upper class kids right. are with getting into Ivy League schools, for example, and that does make me sad. The idea that we're teaching students that, you know, their life will be over if they don't get into Harvard. And I don't think we are cultivating an environment of disempowerment and fear unnecessarily.
Trigger warnings are interesting, and you write a bit about this. And you mentioned trigger warning. The idea, really, it's been something that's been around at least since World War I. The mm-hmm. idea of something triggering, you know, a trauma, someone being upset. So how do you make – what's the distinction, the difference between a trigger warning like that and the trigger warnings we're hearing about on college campuses today?
Well, I know that Angus is going to talk a lot in the next segment about trigger warnings, and I'm glad that you actually brought it up deeper in the interview, because watching some of the discussion of the article, you could think that the entire article was just about trigger warnings. Yeah. And our argument in it is actually that trigger warnings are not necessarily helpful to people who suffer from PTSD. There certainly isn't evidence that they are. They may be compassionate for helping people with PTSD, but they also come with other problems. One of them is student focus, which is essentially if you start saying trigger warning, Anna Karenina includes suicide. Mm-hmm. Difficult things happen there. Is one, there's a spoiler problem, but two, suddenly Anna Karenina becomes a book that's about suicide when it's mm-hmm. actually much deeper, but possibly worst of all, you're telling students who don't suffer from PTSD that there's something to be feared about this book. It's a way of telling people get ready to be scared or traumatized when that might not necessarily be the case. But the thing I'm actually more concerned about as an academic freedom defender and as someone who defends professors all the time is that I think it puts professors in an impossible position. I think that the problem is when Oberlin passed this policy about a year ago where they had mandatory trigger warnings and can encourage professors to avoid topics that might be considered triggering. And by the way, they listed colonialism, racism, classism, basically every single possible ism should be avoided, right. which makes you wonder what on earth are they supposed to teach. There's a reason why the professors, when they finally got to see this thing, all went, no way, we can't teach classes if we have to guess what a student is going to claim might offend them. This is impossible. And it was the same thing that the professors said. There were seven humanities professors who wrote into Inside Higher Education saying the same thing. And they're scared, you know, they're scared for their jobs. And in my experience, I've seen professors get in trouble for much, you know, sillier or more mild things than offending a student over the years. So if you create this impossible expectation for students that essentially it's on the professor to guess what they might claim is offensive or triggering to them, it's going to be a perfect excuse, a perfect tool for getting rid of every provocative professor on campus.
But I think what Angus Johnston will say is that there's a difference between an institution like Oberlin in that case imposing a warning on things like colonialism and some professors like Angus Johnston who just say, hey, I just want to let you know we're going to have a discussion about a violent rape in the course
right.
of this. And you need to know if that makes you feel uncomfortable, you can step out and we'll figure out another way around it. That there's a difference between that, that people who are worried about political correctness are mischaracterizing it as being imposed and censoring and all of those things when it doesn't, at least from Johnston's perspective, doesn't really play out that way.
Right. And I think Angus makes the best case for sort of a limited and voluntary application of trigger warnings.
Yeah.
And I respect his opinion on it. But I think Connor Fiesserdorf wrote about this, and unfortunately I've seen this be the case. I think Eugene Volokh also dubbed the term sort of censorship envy. That some of these slopes can be genuinely slippery. And yes, the most sympathetic scenario is saying, listen, I'm about to discuss something that goes into graphic detail about sexual assault, and just want everyone to know about that. And I understand that makes sense, that it comes from a compassionate place. But the problem is that people then start thinking, wow, OK, so basically it's on the professor to warn me about things that I might find upsetting. What if I find this thing upsetting?
Yeah.
And things can spiral. It can sort of tumble downhill very quickly. And in my experience, they not just can, they do. So, for example, when we just were looking around for different trigger warning policies just this past week, we found at least 7 different schools, I think, that had trigger warning policies that were on their sexual harassment guidelines. So in other words, they were telling students in a piece that only had a trigger warning on it, saying, be careful reading the harassment and assault policy because it deals with sexual harassment and assault. Now, that's pretty bizarre, yeah. But at the same time, I'm used to that kind of stuff happening, where essentially if you sometimes people will say, well, common sense will prevail. I end up being a little less convinced that it will on college campuses, where there is this big, as I talk about from the administrative side, mm-hmm. there's this big incentive to overreact. Yeah. So I understand why professors are scared of it, and I think that Angus makes a lot of great points, but I do think that once you create an expectation that it's on the professor to guess what might actually offend students, it can lead very quickly to some kind of ridiculous results. So, for example, a case I talked about yesterday on NPR was sort of a classic case at FIRE that deals with a professor at a Latin American studies class. And he explains the epithet for Mexican Americans, wetback. He explains its history. He explains where it comes from, that it's legends of people swimming across the Rio Grande, and he condemns its use. Mm-hmm. So he uses an epithet. He explains an epithet in order to explain where it came from and criticize its use. And he was found guilty of racial harassment at Brandeis University because it offended one student. So some of these nightmare scenarios, people are like, oh, these are just a handful of examples. Like, no, they're not a handful of examples. I can bore you to death with hundreds of examples if you read some of what I've written. So I do think sometimes that universities do need to be told that some of these policies can spiral out of control.
You ask this big question in the article, what are we doing to our students if we encourage them to develop extra thin skin before they leave the cocoon of adult protection? And a lot of the article is working through what does in fact happen if you do that. You say in the article that microaggressions comes up, mm-hmm. And you talk about how the focus on emotional reasoning comes into play with a lot of these ideas of microaggressions, and it's just this formula for this constant state of outrage. And mm-hmm. one of the things you want, you say, is you want students to question their emotional reactions, and you
right.
want students to give people the benefit of the doubt, which yep. I gather you think is one of the risks here, that we won't or we don't.
Yeah, I mean, it's best exemplified by this microaggression policing policy that they're trying to hash out at Ithaca College, that happened just in the course of us writing the article. And I want to emphasize this. I think microaggressions are a fascinating topic. I want to see studies on that. I want to see books on the different unconscious and conscious sort of sexist and racist slights that people engage in. And I think that's great. But when you start policing them, but it does come with some problems, that when you actually start policing them, when you actually have any threat of people being punished in the name of increasing candor, I think you're absolutely kidding yourself because you create a more or less a minefield where someone is saying, I am definitely going to say the wrong thing. So I'm not going to bother. And I think it's actually likely to decrease people talking across lines of differences if they think they can get in trouble for it. But I also like to make the point that and this is where I actually do I used to say this a lot at Stanford. It used to really frustrate them, but I believe it to be sincere. When you got the list of the and the explanation of the way people in my human rights class thought that people should talk to each other, I had just come from a year of working with inner city high school kids in Southeast D.C. And I came from, factory and kitchen work myself. And I was looking at this. I'm going, this really kind of reads like what you think upper class Ivy League kids should talk to each other like. I don't think you really understand that if you want genuine candor, you don't have to make the safe space that you should be creating is where people can be wrong and people can actually say things that might even anger each other, not in an environment in which where you have to be walking on eggshells.
About a minute left here. Let me ask you. The article does get around to the idea of what you do then about all of this. You say the answer is not to protect students, but to equip them to be, mm-hmm. you know, more prepared for the words and ideas that may offend their sensibilities. And you go through some of the ways of doing that. Would you say something about that finally? What's the, sort of the way forward? Because you do propose some solutions.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the most enthusiastic about the idea, and partially to deal with the polarization issue too, of just formalized Oxford-style debates that students participate in. You know, make that part of the orientation program because it definitely teaches people that people can disagree productively. It can also teach people that you're not necessarily stupid or evil if you disagree, and it can show that people are strong enough to have principled disagreements. So I think that that kind of training could be great. I also think looking at some of the lessons inherent in CBT. You don't have to practice it, but you can look at the idea of arguing more fairly with each other and try to inculcate that a little bit more.
Greg Lukianoff, he's president and CEO of FIRE. It's the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. He co-wrote, along with Jonathan Haidt, the cover story for the September issue of The Atlantic magazine called The Coddling of the American Mind. We have a link to it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Joined us from the studios of the Atlantic's offices there in New York City. Greg Lukianoff, thanks very much.
Thanks so much.
We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been having another conversation about political correctness, but we're talking about what Greg Lukianoff believes is kind of a new version of this, a new expression of it in the 21st century, focused mostly on students who are trying to be protected in their sensibilities. We had him on the program earlier, and now on the program, Angus Johnston is joining us for another perspective. He's an historian of student activism, student life, and campus culture. He teaches at Hostos Community College of the City University of New York, and he's joining us from the studios of Radio Art in New York City. And Angus Johnston, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let me start with that point that you come to this having studied student activism. That must give you a particular kind of perspective, and I'm wondering how that affects the way you're thinking about this argument.
Well, I think it affects it really primarily in two ways. First is to recognize that one of the constants in American history and generally in higher education is that students don't tend to have a huge amount of impact, of input into how the university is run, how the classroom is run. Administrators and faculty have a huge amount more power than students do. And one of the things that's happening in a situation like this is that students are pressing for their voices to be heard, for more power. And it sometimes gets portrayed as if they're running the institutions when in fact they're operating from a real disadvantage and always have been. The other thing that I would note about today's moment is that the American university and college campus is a tremendous amount more diverse than it is has ever been before. And I think when we're talking about whether students feel comfortable in the university, feel accepted in the classroom, I think we also have to acknowledge that the demographics of the university are changing and that the demographics of the student body are changing a lot more quickly than the faculty and administrative demographics.
We'll get to some details here in a moment. But what is your general impression of the idea that we heard from Greg Lukianoff that today's college kids are the products of, you know, on one hand, parents who coddle them, on the other hand, a media that's made them terrified, on the other hand, this very polarized political culture, and that makes them have a very different particular kind of perspective. Do you agree with that in some sense?
Well, I think that one of the things that's happening is that young people, college students, are feeling more ability to challenge some of the stuff that's been going on for a very long time. than they have before. That they're standing up to their professors more often. It's not as if students have never felt like their professors were sexually harassing them before. It's not as if students have never felt like professors were occasionally saying, you know, racially or ethnically insensitive things. What's scary to a lot of faculty is that students are being much more vocal in their opposition to some of that stuff than they have been in the past.
Hmm. You know, it's one of the things that Lukianoff writes in his article that this new generation of young people, but because they use social media, he thinks it's fundamentally shifted the balance of power in that relationship between a student and a teacher. Now, what you just said earlier was it doesn't really work that way. They don't, in fact, have that much power. But it is interesting, the use of social media in all of this. It does give them an outlet that they didn't have in the past.
Absolutely. And, I think that Greg is right that it has shifted the balance of power. I don't think it's shifted anywhere near equality, but it's shifted toward the students and away from professors, and I think that's a good thing.
What do you make of this idea that this the millennials maybe or this newer generation is that the new spin on the so-called PC movement is that they're more focused on emotional well-being, that their emotions are particularly raw? What do you make of that finding from Greg Lukianoff?
I think that's a really interesting claim, and I think there really is some merit to it. But I think one of the questions that I would have is why is that happening? And I'm not sure that I'm entirely convinced by Greg's answers to that question. We have an American student body which is majority female now for the first time in a very long time, and women are socialized to frame arguments in ways that are different from the ways that men have been socialized to frame arguments. Mm. I think that we have a society as a whole which is a lot more aware of and sensitive to issues of trauma, issues of mental health, issues of these kinds of concerns than we were a generation ago or two generations ago. And so one of the things that I think is probably happening is that students are making arguments, framing arguments in ways that they believe that people will respond to. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I like to say is that I'm going to generally get a lot more traction if I say that you are a bigot than I am if I say that you're a jerk. If people would listen and respond more when others accused them of being jerks, I think some of these other arguments wouldn't be invoked quite as frequently.
It seems like a lot of this is about that ongoing and constant tension between the generations. Because it seems like you're hearing people like Jerry Seinfeld saying, I don't really want to do gigs on college campuses anymore because everyone is too precious and they can't really take a joke. But what you seem to be saying is, hey, Jerry, maybe your jokes aren't funny to this generation.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that was really surprising to me in its lack of self-awareness about that Jerry Seinfeld interview is that the example that he gave of students being overly fastidious and politically correct was that his joke about an effeminate gay king, Frenchman, right. An effeminate French gay king wasn't landing the way that it used to. And it's like, well, dude, that doesn't sound like a very funny joke at all.
Yeah. So a lot of this then is people are saying, so we don't like to be told we're square, which even saying square kind of gives away my age, right? But I mean, or that we're old and we're not really that, we don't really get it anymore.
Absolutely. And I think that this is one of the things that is really scary about being a professor right now. And I'm a professor. I'm in my mid-40s. I am not a member of the youth of today. The rules are changing, and the rules are changing really quickly. What you're supposed to say and what you're not supposed to say, what's okay to say and what's not okay to say is changing really rapidly. And I think a lot of us who were used to being the cool kids. We're used to being the good guys. We're used to being the people who were, whose rectitude was never called into question. I think we really kind of tend to freak out when somebody suggests that maybe we're the bad guys.
You don't really see this as censorship. You see this as debate. You know, when you hear objections to commencement speakers or when you hear concern about particular words or subjects in classes, what you're saying is, hey, this is speech. And this kicks up. And this, I guess this leads to a good thing, and that is to debate. I mean, it may seem absurd to some, but you seem to be saying that the good thing is that this is raising a discussion and good things are coming from that.
Absolutely. And one of the things that comes up again and again in Greg's article is the idea that once you say that something is offensive, that's the end of the discussion. You automatically win. Once you claim that somebody is a bigot, then you've automatically won the argument. But the reality is that most attempts that students make to, for instance, get somebody disinvited from giving a commencement address, which is, I think, a complex question from the perspective of free speech in the first place. But most of their attempts fail. Yeah. Most of the attempts to impose, for instance, mandatory trigger warnings have come from students and have gone absolutely nowhere. There is no country in there is no college in the country that has imposed mandatory trigger warnings. What has happened as a result of these demands and these requests is a huge amount of attention to these questions and a huge amount of debate and a huge amount of argument, very frequently culminating in the students being shouted down. So I find the debate invigorating.
Yeah. You talk about the use of the word retarded.
Yes.
How that used to play and how it plays now. And would you talk about that? Because I think it's a good example of what's going on.
Yeah. I was thinking about this summer at a student conference that I was at where people are like, well, you know, there's all of this sensitivity and there's all of this, you know, hyper correction of what people say. And I was thinking about the fact that just 5 or 6 years ago, it was not uncommon at all for me to hear, you know, progressive New York City liberal, very, you know, PC types use the word retarded as a pejorative. And it was disturbing to me for a variety of reasons, including the fact that I have a sister with a severe cognitive disability who herself really doesn't like that word. But it occurred to me, I basically never hear that word used that way anymore.
Right.
And I think that's a good thing. I think, you know, one of the things that Greg says is, you know, we're entering an age where people are thinking twice for fear of being called offensive. Well, okay, I think that's a good thing. Let's be conscious of what we're saying and the fact that it may have an impact that's not the impact that we are seeking to have.
It's interesting. I want to ask you about trigger warnings because you include trigger warnings in your teaching. And let's talk a little bit about how you see them, what they are and what they aren't. Because you've talked about how part of the confusion arises from that word, trigger.
Yes. Yeah, I actually don't use the term trigger warning in my syllabus. I call it a course content note.
Yeah.
And there's two reasons for that. One is, frankly, my students have never heard of trigger warnings. They're not a part of this debate that's going on in a fairly rarefied way. I teach at a community college in the Bronx. This is not a debate that most of them are plugged into. Right. And so if I use the term trigger warning, I would first have to explain the term before I explain the warning.
Right.
The other reason is that I think the utility of this kind of a warning goes beyond sort of clinical psychological triggers. I think, you know, what I try to do with my content note in the syllabus is to say, number one, just as a heads up, we're going to be dealing with some stuff that may be pretty intense, and that if you have a personal background or a life experience which is, you know, going to lead you to potentially be more than normally traumatized by this, A, just be aware that this is something that may come up, and B, please come and talk to me in advance. You know, the example that I give is that sometimes we talk about, the lynching of Emmett Till, a young teenager, or the death of Charles Darwin's 10-year-old daughter, and the way that that devastated him. Well, if one of my students is a parent who has recently lost a child, that might hit them hard.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a father of two living children, and Darwin's eulogy for his daughter hits me pretty hard. If I had lost a kid, I think I probably wouldn't want to hear my professor reading that. I would want to not be in the room when that happened. And so if that's the effect that my lecture is likely to have on you, I would like to know that in advance so that we can work together to figure out a way to bring you into the conversation, to make the conversation one which is not going to cause you to shut down, not going to cause you additional trauma, not going to alienate you from the classroom community.
It's interesting, too, that you're seeing a classroom as a different place than where a lot of public discourse plays out, like, for example, on the internet. It's a shared space. It's an interactive space. It's an unpredictable
space. It's a community
space
that we build together, yeah.
Work me through that, because I think that's really interesting. We have to see a classroom as a different place than just a discussion we're having in a chat room on the internet.
Well, one of the things is that you spend a lot of time in a classroom. And if it's a discussion-oriented room like mine generally tend to be, then you're going to build up some sort of a connection with the other people in that room over the course of the semester. I think that I'm probably particularly sensitive to this, frankly, because I am a middle-aged white guy teaching at a college whose student body is 2/3 women and about 95% students of color. And so if I'm going to be talking about racism, if I'm going to be talking about slavery or lynching or any of these things, that distinction in our identities is going to come into play, and it's something that's going to have to be bridged in some way. I guess this is what I would say, that if you want to talk about really difficult stuff in a classroom, if you want to go to the places that are hard to go to, which is the goal, right? That's the goal particularly of the people who are against trigger warnings and against PC. They want to go to the hard places and do the hard stuff. If you want to do that successfully, you need to have a certain level of trust between the students and the professor, because if the students don't trust the professor, they will check out in one way or another.
I wonder what your impressions are of the argument made by Lukianoff and Haidt in this Atlantic article about, again, I'll be careful here, he doesn't make a direct causal connection between the PC culture and mental illness rates among young adults, but he is worried what PC culture is doing to rates of, I guess he's thinking of depression and other mental illness issues among young adults. What's your reaction to that?
Well, the one stat in the article was a 5-point uptick in, I believe, rates of depression from 49 to 54, something like that, over the course of 5 years. That strikes me as a small effect and a small sample size – well, not a small sample size, but a narrow time range. So I'm not sure that it's happening. And if it is happening, I'm not sure that it's a huge effect, and I'm not quite sure what to attribute it to. I will say, though, again, that I do think that we are becoming more willing to publicly acknowledge mental distress, mental illness, mental disabilities than we were in the past, that people are a lot more likely to be open about them and a lot more likely to say, you know what, I'm going to refuse to be shamed for this. I'm going to say that even though I am somebody who has, you know, an anxiety disorder or depression or a mental illness, that doesn't mean that in all occasions, in all circumstances, I have to accommodate myself to the professor. In fact, I'm going to stand up and say that in some circumstances, the professor is going to have to accommodate himself or herself to me.
Any opinion on his views, I'll say their views, I guess, on this cognitive behavioral therapy as a method
I thought
here?
Elements of that were really interesting and exciting. I'm not really sure that I agree with the policy element of it, the ways in which they translate it to policy. The biggest example of that is trigger warnings. They say, well, the reason that trigger warnings are bad is that if you have experienced trauma, what you need is controlled and managed exposure to the source of the trauma.
Yeah, well, not protect them from it, expose them from it.
Right, exactly. Don't protect them from it. Yeah. Don't keep them away from it, but expose them to it in a way that is controlled and can allow them to overcome it. That's exactly what a trigger warning is intended to do, or at least what my trigger warnings are intended to do, and most of the ones that I've seen from faculty. They are not intended as a get-out-of-jail-free card to say, you know, you can skip this week's class. That's not the way that they have been framed in my experience. The way they're framed is, this is something that's coming up. Let's talk. If it's going to be difficult for you from an emotional or a psychological perspective, let's talk about how to reduce the level of difficulty of that so that you can face it, so that you can participate. I think he's got the trigger warning thing exactly backwards.
It is interesting, too, the way he sees the way young people seem to be processing people who disagree with them, as I talked to him a little bit about this subjective feeling of being offended becomes this impression that someone who disagrees is objectively wrong.
Yeah.
Anything to say about that?
Yeah. This is a thing that I think the thing to do about that is to have me and Greg to get together over a beer and tape that, and we'll hash it out over the course of about an hour and a half, because I think we could do it. But here's the thing. The idea that my subjective opinion about your behavior is objectively true is just sort of an aggressive way of saying my subjective opinion about your behavior is something that you should respect and take seriously, which is, I think, when phrased that way, generally true. The way I frame it is this. If I've offended you without intending to, if I meant to offend you, then mission accomplished. Mm-hmm. But if I've offended you without intending to, then in some sense I have screwed up because I have failed in my goal, which was to have an interaction with you which did not alienate you from me. It may not be my fault. I may not be a bad person. It may not make me evil. But it was, let's say, a failing. It was a non-optimal outcome. And one of the things about these lists of microaggressions and that kind of thing is just to say, you should know that if you say this in a certain context, there's a non-zero chance that people are going to be bugged by it, and a non-zero chance that people are going to think you're a jerk. That's information that I think is useful to have. We can discuss whether it's appropriate for people to think you're a jerk if you say something that's innocent, and we can discuss how people should be forgiven for their, you know, their sins and all of that. But I think that we also have to say that for a very long time, saying, well, I didn't mean it. I didn't intend to cause offense. I didn't know you were going to be offended. I didn't know that you were going to think that that was a bad thing. I didn't think it was weird to ask you where you're really from just because you're Asian and, you know, turns out you were born in Brooklyn. But when I say, where are you really from? I didn't mean anything by it. Well, yeah, okay, you didn't mean anything by it, but this is something that this person has probably heard a bunch of times and gets under their skin every time. So you should probably not do that in the future.
Angus Johnston teaches at Hostos Community College, City University of New York, joined us today from the studios of Radio Art in New York City. Angus Johnston, thanks very much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.